The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Champions League Final Special. The final whistle blew minutes ago and we've selected an A-list panel to talk you through Bayern Munich's 1-0 victory over Paris Saint-Germain in a breathless football match. Questions then, was it a good game? Did the best team win? How did they do it? Is Hansi Flick a genius? And is this a victory for football itself? And what of PSG? Closer than ever before, but not close enough. You've asked lots of questions. We'll answer them. And we'll cover the Europa League final. Harry Maguire in Mykonos. And that'll do for today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson. Good evening.
Good evening.
Johnny Liu. Good evening.
Hiya.
Barry Glendening. Good evening.
It's a great evening.
Are you excited, Barry, to be recording at 21 minutes past 10 on a Sunday night? Do you think you'll perform better or worse at this time of the day?
I suppose we'll find out soon enough. I've just had a Coronetto. I've got a glass of red wine on the go. And everything is well in the world.
Marvellous news. What flavour Cornetto was it?
Strawberry.
Ah, strawberry Cornetto and red wine. The cultured man's Champions League final accoutrements. All right, then. Paris Saint-Germain 0, Bayern Munich 1. Bayern's sixth Champions League victory. They're tied with Liverpool, if you include European Cups as well. Obviously, one behind AC Milan, seven behind Real Madrid. Kingsley Coman's goal was Bayern Munich's 500th Champions League goal. Which was your favourite, Barry? No, you don't have to answer that one. The pace of this game, Wilson, I thought was sort of pretty wild, especially sort of midway through, from the start of the game to midway through the second half. Was it a good game of football?
Yeah, I thought certainly the first half was really good. I couldn't quite understand the commentary on BT and various people on Twitter saying it was cagey. I mean, That's not what cagey looks like. Cagey is when teams aren't trying to score. Cagey is when they're playing very negatively and very defensively. I thought that first half was astonishingly high quality. And, you know, when two good teams play against each other, sometimes they do a bit of defending. And I know that's not fashionable these days, but sometimes they do it. And I guess it sort of, the first half went as we thought it might. The Bayern were the more proactive, had more of the ball, and PSG were very dangerous on the break. And PSG, as Leon had had, as Barcelona had early chances and missed them. But then second half, I don't know, I sort of felt the game had started to slightly lose its way, and then suddenly Bayern scored a brilliant goal. And then after that, the fact PSG, apart from arguably the penalty shout that Mbappe had and Neymar had one chance very late on, they didn't really get back in the game. And I think that was a really impressive thing from Bayern's point of view, the way that they did exert control in the second half.
It's one of those games, Johnny, that I found sort of, it was so relentless, I almost felt I was out of breath, even though I was just sitting on the sofa.
Yeah, I mean, the first 30, 40 minutes were incredible. I think the pace sort of slowed a little bit in the third quarter, and that, I think, was a function not just of the circumstances with no atmosphere, but also PSG's, you know, lack of real competitive preparation. I think that really showed in the second half. I mean, I was keeping an eye on the distance covered stats during the game, and after about half an hour, it became clear that Herrera and Marquinhos were doing basically most of PSG's running. Not mathematically most of it, but kind of proportionally more than the rest of the team, and. It felt like they couldn't really keep it up, and you could see that during the second half. I think Bayern had much more control of the second half than they probably would have anticipated. So I think, you know, I mean, the pace of it was really quite thrilling in the first 30, 40 minutes, but I think the second half felt more like a conventional Champions League final, if that makes any sense.
Barry, there were lots of questions before about whether Bayern would play a high line against PSG's strike force and would they do anything different? And they didn't seem to do anything different. They still did kind of what they've done all the time, which is concede a few chances or PSG could get on the break with the ball over the top.
Yeah, true. And I'm not sure if it's because they were in the final or they just had one of those days, but Neymar and Kylian Mbappe could have scored a couple of goals, didn't. You could possibly put it down as another PSG choke. I think that would be too simplistic. Manuel Neuer made some good saves. And I'd be honest, while I've made no secret of the fact that I wanted PSG to lose, I'm slightly disappointed they didn't make a bit more of a game of it. I certainly thought they'd score at least once. I thought there'd be more goals in this game. But I think Bayern were deserving winners in the end. And the two Jonathans, I was perplexed at halftime when I had a peep at Twitter and saw that people were saying it was cagey, because sort of my first note was incredibly frantic start. I quite enjoyed the game. It wasn't a classic by any stretch of the imagination, but I've seen far worse Champions League finals.
Oh, what's your second note on the pad?
Manuel Neuer saves from Neymar.
Factually accurate notes so far. This is classic journalism for anyone interested interested in getting into the business. Before we talk about Manuel Neuer, because I'd like to talk about him a bit. The goal was a beautiful goal, wasn't it, Wilson?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, the move was great. Yeah, just sort of the flow of it, the angles of the passes. It was Müller and Thiago Alcantara who sort of were key in the sort of beginning and middle stage of it. And then the cross from Kimmich was perfect. It's sort of, I don't know, there's something about those very soft, very slow crosses that kind of gives them an extra aura. And it was in a sense, it was reminiscent of his goal against Dortmund just after the restart. So, you know, him chipping the ball has been a key part in them winning the league and then in them winning this final. And I thought Koeman, after a slightly difficult start, was probably the most dangerous player for Bayern in the first half. And obviously, you know, the only change to the team, which I have to say I was slightly surprised by. I thought Persic had been very good in the quarterfinal and semi-final. But, you know, he did get on top of Kehrer. And then, you know, the slightly odd thing, you would have said Perisic was more likely to get on the end of a back post cross. But, you know, I guess it was more to do with movement and space than necessarily heading ability.
Is your favourite kind of cross a slow, floaty cross then, Wilson? I'm surprised.
I think there's a, you know, one of the beauties of crossing is that it has so many forms. I think there is a beauty to the slow, floaty cross. I think there's a beauty to the whipped cross. I think the hanging cross is nice. I like a very deep cross as well. Sometimes the ball cut back. You know, there's a lot of different crosses. Much like the Christian symbol of the cross, you get the Roman one, you get the Greek one, you get the Orthodox one, the Egyptian one, the Ethiopian one. So also in football, there are manifold crosses.
You were shaking your head there, Johnny.
Yeah, no, I was shaking my head. Yeah, the best cross is the early low cross, the early low outswinging cross that just evades the last defender and the last attacker just manages to get to. And that geometrically, I think that's geometrically, aesthetically, technically, that's the best cross.
Well, you say that, but if you'd spent most of the late 90s watching Michael Gray hitting long diagonals to Niall Quinn, I think you'd disagree.
It's got to be a low cross. It's got to be a...
Not to Niall Quinn, it doesn't. That's the last thing you want, to Niall Quinn.
We had a player called Paul Rayner who used to put in, they were so high and slow, these crosses. They took... Quite often, we could waste 10 minutes of a game just waiting for the cross to fall. Barry, do you have anything to add to this interesting debate about delivery from wide?
No.
Okay. There is an interesting point about Kingsley Coman. He came in for Perisic. And Mohamed Butt writing here, you know, before everyone goes wild with the hagiographies of Coman, it's worth remembering that he beat his girlfriend up in 2017, has admitted to that fact. Izzy says... What about Sephora Gwanyan, I hope I pronounced that correctly, who Coman domestically abused, yet has shown no remorse for doing so? Surely it doesn't matter how long ago this was. He's shown no remorse. Why has no commentator mentioned this? Am I missing something? So Johnny, definitely worth bringing that up, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the complexity of humans is that these things can coexist, that you can have done, you know, things in your personal life and yet still score the winning goal in the Champions League final. And some people, I mean, I think that the nature of online discourse is that the act of saying one of those things feels like it's erasing the other one, but it doesn't. I mean, those things do, you know, can coexist. And, you know, without being overly familiar with the details of Kingsley Coman's private life, I think it's, you know, it's fair to bring that up at a time like this when he's being lauded for, you know, scoring the winning goal, for being like a, you know, great footballer. It's not inappropriate to raise that. So that's what I have to say about that.
Jonathan, how much credit do we give to Hansi Flick for what has actually been quite an incredible run for Bayern Munich?
I think I give him a lot of credit. I still sort of think it's a worry for the Bundesliga that Bayern can have been such a mess up until November and still end up winning the Bundesliga very, very easily. But the flip side of that is, one of the reasons they've won it is they have been brilliant for the last, I mean, certainly since, I guess, December. The Hansi Flick had that very slightly dodgy start when they lost a couple of games. But even those two games, I think they were slightly unlucky to lose. But yeah, I mean, they've got a... Yeah, he obviously has a great squad to work with. And I think it was notable even tonight when you think of the resources PSG have. But you looked at the two benches, and Bayern's bench is much, much stronger. But... Yeah, the you compare the football they're playing now to the football they're playing in October, and it's night and day. They press better than anybody else in Europe, which is more to do with organisation and discipline and work than it is to do with personnel. Oh yeah, you know, it's the two have to go hand in hand with that. You can't sort of improvise that. I think even the way they played in the second half today compared to the first half, you saw that the changes Flick had made to just sort of close those gaps that were there in the first half.
I mean, I think that's really the story of this final. When it came down to it, I haven't seen the XG or anything, but PSG had loads of opportunities to get into the Bayern final third and didn't really seem to know what they were doing, and that comes from, you know, not really having a drilled or organised pattern of play in the final third. And Bayern seemed to know what they seemed to know what they were doing. They seemed to know where, you know, where their teammates were going to be. They seemed to have drilled patterns of play. They seemed to have kind of really well choreographed attacking patterns. And if that's, I mean, if there's any kind of narrative or any kind of theme to come out of this final, it's the fact that the better team kind of won over the team that is basically built around individuals and saying, you know, get the ball to these really talented individuals and they will, you know, they will find a way to get the ball to the goal. And I think what we found tonight is that when Mbappe and Neymar and to a lesser extent Di Maria got the ball in the final third, they couldn't quite do that because they really hadn't been drilled for these sorts of situations that they found themselves in. I found that quite interesting, that in many ways this was a triumph of the collective over the collection of individuals.
By the same token, Bayern seemed to target Thilo Kehrer, who didn't have a good game. Coman scored, got above him for the header, and he was just conspicuously bad throughout the game. And I, when I saw his number, I had to check who he was, and it wasn't a name I was familiar with. So, you know, PSG have this team with a selection of superstars, but also a few no marks, unless I'm...
Well, they've
something.
Been slightly screwed over there. The same way the team of Werner left Leipzig sort of without the season being finished. So PSG lost Thomas Meunier, the Belgian fullback. So he presumably would have played. So while Leipzig were clearly harder hit in the sense that they have fewer resources. So when they lose one, you know, their top scorer, that's a massive thing. PSG did lose Cavani and Meunier.
They did still have chances, but Manuel Neuer is an absolutely brilliant goalkeeper. There was a fun moment in the commentary where Steve McManaman went, "He's like Superman, thou shalt not pass," getting his Superman and his Gandalfs muddled up there. But he's an extraordinary keeper, isn't it? You know, and I know often you say, Barry, look, they are part of the team. You know, you're allowed to have a good goalkeeper. It's not if he wasn't there and they just put a stick man there, it would be slightly different. But he's so sort of effortlessly good at being a goalkeeper, which is a really useful thing to have.
Well, there's two things there, I think. One is you have to play a line as high as they play. You have to have a keeper who plays that far outside the box. And that does mean every now and again you'll get caught out embarrassingly and everybody will laugh about it. But the other 95%, 99% of the time, yeah, he sort of cuts out those obvious balls over the top. So, you know, he's vital from that point of view. But I think the other interesting thing about him is that I think there was a tendency, and I guess I was guilty of this as well, to sort of think that injury had sort of finished him. That you remember the player he was in the 2018 World Cup when he really didn't look anything like the player he had been before the injury. And he'd obviously been rushed back. But that even seemed to carry on the following season. But this last, you know, year or so, he's been back to his best and playing brilliantly. So, I think it is worth remembering that keepers, you know, they don't get stuck on some tracks and inevitably go to a destination. They can go through on a bad form and come out the other side of it.
On the subject of goalkeepers, can I ask, well, either Jonathan, but I suppose it's one for Jonathan Wilson. Keylor Navas, on a few occasions when taking goal kicks, would just sort of play it a couple of yards to his defender who was, you know, 6 feet away from him or less. What is the idea behind that?
Well, I mean, that player is not under pressure because an opponent can't come in the box until he's touched the ball. So you are playing the ball to a player. And then the forward has to come towards you. And then I guess the hope is that space opens up. Whereas if Navas just launched it, then, yeah, it's effectively 50-50 in the air. So I assume that's the logic. I mean, I guess ideally you have a keeper who's, you know, like Edison or something, who is a really good passer as well and can play sort of 50-yard balls to feet where it's not such a lottery when they're going long. I mean, you remember that game... when was it? Three seasons ago? When
no, I don't remember that game.
when City beat Tottenham 4-1 at the Etihad, and Tottenham pressed them really high on goal kicks, and Edison just kept pinging these 50-yard passes to feet on the halfway line, and you sort of think, well, what are you meant to do? Tottenham are doing the brave right thing of pressing hard on the fullbacks. Edison's hitting these brilliant long passes and. There's something like 70-75% of his long passes found the target that day, which is a ridiculously high percentage for any sort of player.
Well, one of the motifs of the first half, in a way, was Neuer kind of pinging these 40 or 50 yard balls to Kimmich or Davis on the left. And I mean, the point I wanted to make was that this kind of stuff doesn't just happen. It comes through making. You know, your goalkeeper kind of an integral part of how you play it, which is what obviously Bayern have done with Neuer for the last few years. And if you contrast that with the way that I mean, PSG have gone through so many keepers in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, they had Rico in the knockout rounds. Obviously, they brought back Keylor Navas here, but you know, in the last few seasons they've had Buffon and Trapp, and it feels like. If you make the goalkeeping position a kind of a bolt on, you know, if it's sort of an afterthought to how you want to play, then getting your goalkeeper to create play in that way is going to be much less natural than it seems to be for Bayern, who have been playing in that style for so many years. I mean, that's was a real key kind of component of how Bayern managed to build play, and certainly in the first half. That Neuer was able to just, you know, essentially move the ball into midfield effortlessly.
And at the absolute highest level, which is what this game is, do you think now it's impossible not to have a goalkeeper that can do that? Because essentially it's an extra outfield player when you've got the ball.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends on the way you play. But, you know, if you have a backboard that kind of sit on top of your goalkeeper, then obviously it's not going to be so much of an imperative. But the way that Bayern play and the way that opposition teams will try and press them, it's such an asset. I mean, you see it with Edison as well at City. It's such an asset to just be able to kind of move the ball 50 or 60 yards up the pitch. And that kind of has to be a thrust of how you build attacks. So it's not a necessity, but I think the way that teams like Bayern want to play, it kind of is.
Well, I think it's interesting from that point of view, that where, you know, pretty much the one high-ish level team Joe Hart could have gone to was Tottenham, because Mourinho is pretty much the only high-ish level coach who still plays with a low block. So, you know, Joe Hart at Tottenham was the only, their statuses meant they almost had to kind of go together.
But they're high-ish. They're never going to be, can you be high-ist with that?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question.
Thank you so much. It's taken 3 years.
I didn't really hear it, to be honest. I'm just being polite.
That's the Wi-Fi. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll ask some very searing questions about Thomas Tuchel and PSG. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Champions League special with Barry, Glenn Denning, Johnny Liu and Jonathan Wilson. Spud says, is there something extra sad about Thomas Tuchel having to hop off to the locker room? I don't know if that's extra sad, but were you surprised about the substitutions that Tuchel made? A lot of people going slightly wild about that on social media.
He got a lot of heat for his substitutions. I think he brought Verratti on in the second half. I think he took Herrera off and he took Paredes off and he took Herrera off. And then, you know, when they were chasing a goal with sort of 15 minutes to go, he brought on the now legendary Eric Choupo-Moting. I don't know what the reasoning was behind that. Clearly there was some sort of reasoning, but when you leave a player of the caliber of Mauro Icardi on the bench when you're chasing a goal in the Champions League final, you are going to get questions asked of you. It seemed like when the teams came out that PSG would have more than enough firepower from the bench. You know, both teams would have so much firepower from the bench to be able to change the game. But the weird thing was that even after making those substitutions, PSG just essentially seemed to be playing in the same kind of amorphous style, in the same kind of poorly defined shape. And I suppose that is on Tuchel in I guess what would have been the biggest game of his life, that he was so unable to affect the game from the bench.
We shouldn't judge anyone on one game, but can we judge Thomas Tuchel on not winning the Champions League, since by all accounts it's all that the PSG owners care about, Wilson?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they clearly improved since he took over. I mean, he's been there, 2 years now? And this has been their best performance in the Champions League ever, getting to the final. It's been their best result ever getting to the final, but I think it's also been their best performances. They've looked a more integrated side. I think the changes made in midfield have been sensible. I think they're slightly hamstrung by the quality of the fullbacks, which Meunier obviously is part of that. I don't think that Bernat and Kerr are absolutely A-plus grade fullbacks. I've never been impressed by Kimpembe either. So I think still the recruitment, although it's been expensive, hasn't necessarily been great. So he has definitely made them better. And, you know, if you get to the final and you only lose by a single goal and you've missed chance in the first half, you're not that far from winning, are you? It's kind of, I don't know. I think it's very easy to get hung up on results in knockout competitions, but the performances have been pretty good.
Yeah, because like we're questioning Tuchel's substitutions. Bayern won. They won by one goal. It could have gone the other way, and you could question Hansi Flick's decision to take off a pair of wingers who were wreaking a lot of havoc. And if, say, PSG had got a late equaliser and gone on to win, we'd all be pointing and laughing at Hansi Flick, going, what on earth were you doing? There's very fine margins, and if the result goes your way, you're a genius. If it doesn't, you're an idiot.
Well, yeah, because I mean, you can spin it around, can't you? You can say, what if PSG hadn't got the late equaliser and win against Atalanta? Does that make Tuchel a disaster? I mean, probably it would have been regardless of that, but you know, I don't think it would have done it. You know, I think as well, you know, the circumstances of, you know, of the you know, the one-off games from the quarterfinals onwards, it's very hard to kind of draw any hard and fast conclusions over from the last couple of weeks.
Jason says, what does Neymar do? Or what has he done to warrant being regarded as one of the best footballers in the world? Ben says, is there any better sight in football than Neymar crying?
Well, he's brilliant. Neymar's fantastic. he's better at football than, you know, 99.9999% of humans in the world. He's won the Champions League already. And he's got within one game of doing so again. I mean, the Neymar baiting is kind of it's turned into sort of a sport, really. And you know, you could talk for ages about, you know, the various foibles. That you could talk about the diving, the tears, and you know, and the entourage, the lifestyle, and it all just seems so. I don't know, it just seems kind of banal in a way, banal and trivial. I mean, the way that we talk about Neymar in a way that we don't really talk about any other footballer, which I find that really weird, because it seems to me in terms of talent and in terms of what he's done in the game, he's done fine. He's done pretty well.
Do you think that comes up with, do you think that's because of transfer fees? When a player costs so much money, it seems to change how we discuss them in every which way.
Well, I don't think it was the transfer fee, because like this stuff has been following Neymar ever since he was at Santos. You know, this idea that he's basically kind of a luxury footballer, he's some sort of playboy, sort of, you know, a performing seal. And I think that, you know, what he's done in the game, and if you watch him, you know, for 90 minutes or for a whole season, I just don't think it stands up. And I think what happens is people conflate his persona and his lifestyle outside the game with what he does on the pitch. I mean, he did some interview maybe a year or two ago with Globo, the Brazilian TV channel, and he says, you know, what I do off the pitch is my own business. You don't have a right to comment about what I do off the pitch. What I do on the pitch is basically all, it's the only thing that you are entitled to comment on. And if you look at what he's done in the club and the international game, I still don't think it's appropriate to say that he's you know some sort of, you know, fraud or chancer or somebody who squandered his talent. He's won too much and he's achieved too much to bring him into that conversation. And you know, he didn't have the greatest game tonight, but he still ran more than pretty much any other PSG player on the pitch. He did fine. He did okay.
Yes and no. So I first saw him live in 2011 at the Copa America, when he was bullied twice by Paraguay, coming to that tournament with huge reputation, which is part of the fascination of him, that in Brazil he's been put on this pedestal from a ludicrously early age, and the pressure on him in Brazil is absurd.
And he was what, like 18?
Yeah, he did, he was definitely in his teens. I can't remember exactly. So yeah, absurd expectation. And then the 2014 World Cup. I mean, Brazil was such a ridiculous, hysterical place. He was, you know, the position he was in there was absurd. And he was, I think that forced him to try and do too much in games. I mean, I remember doing a sidebar in the opening game when they beat Croatia 3-1, but didn't play particularly well. And he just kept getting in Oscar's way, which I guess is partly to do with organisation, says to do with the coach, he maybe says to do with Oscar. But it felt like everything was so Neymar-centric. It was stopping Brazil playing properly. So while that's not necessarily his fault, he is the cause of that. Then the 2015 Copa America, So, you know, he got the injury into Colombia in the World Cup. They play Colombia in the final group game at the Copa America in 2015. Colombia obviously are physical with him. He loses rag completely, gets sent off, pushes the referee, gets banned for four games, and Brazil go out of the tournament as a result. So he causes them to go out of two Copa Americas, partly because there's too much focus on him, but partly because he hasn't really responded to that. And I thought in 2018, although he had a reasonably good World Cup, if you look at what he did in terms of assists, in terms of goals, he still, I mean, I remember I was in Samara for the last 16 game against Mexico. His determination to get a Mexican sent off stopped Brazil playing as well as they should have done. It was him who broke up Brazil's rhythm. And then against Belgium, Roberto Martinez targeted that flank, which was not just Neymar, it was Coutinho and Felipe Luis as well, and playing Lukaku on that side and Meunier on that side. The two of them got the better of the three Brazilians and gave Belgium a huge advantage. So there have been a series of incidents, particularly in international football, where the Neymar centrality of the team has cost the team. I think a lot of the criticism of Neymar recently has been unfair. And I think this last fortnight has been as good as I've ever seen him play. You can argue today there was a couple of moments late on when you saw the little glimmers of the old petulance. I mean, his booking was ridiculous, but a lot of players get booked stupidly when they're losing a final. My point is, I think he has changed. I think that the criticism of him was valid for a long time, and people haven't really moved on to the fact that he's moved on.
One trivial thing, though, Johnny Lou, he did get off a bus and play music out of his phone without headphones, which I don't think is trivial. I think that is really quite a high crime. And it reminds me a bit of quite a lot of people are now cycling with a kind of cylindrical boombox on their bicycle to play music to everybody who is walking the streets. And I feel this is very inconsiderate, because I don't want to hear Neymar's music or the man on the bike with the boombox.
It all kind of depends what he was doing on the bus, I think. I mean, I think we could all agree that playing your own music on a bus is quite rude. But equally, it's possible that as soon as he got off the bus, he thought, right, well, you know, I've kind of restrained myself. I've been polite and I've been considerate. Now I'm off the bus. You know, turn it up and let's rip. So you know, it kind of depends on your pre-existing view of Neymar, really.
Very, very good point. Lovely stat from Richard Jolly. Bayern Munich have picked a Müller in their starting 11 in 72% of their European Cup Champions League finals. In the other 28%, they were Müller light. Yogurt pots for stats there, Barry. Lloyd says, what is the best football trophy aesthetically? There's a lovely picture of Lucas Hernandez wearing the trophy on his head in celebration. Literally, his head, basically, he's replaced his head with the inverted European Cup. But would you say the European Cup is the most...
Wouldn't it be just brilliant if it got stuck and some firemen had to come and cut him out of it?
No, he'd have to do the whole of next season with the European Cup on his head, and they just cut out little eye holes for him. Would you say the European Cup is the most aesthetically pleasing of the football trophies?
My favourite is the Europa League trophy, formerly known as the UEFA Cup. I think that is a beautiful piece of silverware.
And deceptively heavy, apparently. If you talk to any player who's won it, one of the first things they always say is, it's really heavy. And it gets past you and you're like, oh God, give it to somebody else because I'm going to drop it here.
How many times have I told the stealing the Rumbelows Carling Carabao Cup? On a punt in Cambridge and realizing quite how heavy it was and almost dropping it into the river. How many times have I told that anecdote enough times that I shouldn't tell it again?
I don't think I've heard this one.
Wow. So the first ever game that ITV Digital put on was Cambridge United v West Brom, I think, in the Carabao Cup, whatever it was called then. And famously, it would have been cheaper for them to just pay for all the viewers to just transport them to the ground and pay for them to have entry and then put them up in a hotel or something. But they were doing like the pre-match filming. And at the time I worked on the river in Cambridge as a punt chauffeur. And so they obviously put the Carabao Cup on a punt and were just punting it down the river. And I was punting a load of tourists the other way. And I just saw the Carabao Cup punting past. So I just let down and picked it up and put it in our boat and sort of celebrated with it and punted off the other way. And then a lot of people with headsets and clipboards started running up the banks of the river, getting very scared because apparently it's worth a few million pounds and I stole it. But also just much heavier than I thought it would be. So there you are. Luke says, would you rather wrestle one Sula or five Kimmicks? Jim says, how heartwarming is it to see lads the size of Nicolas Sula playing in Europe's biggest game, hashtag unit? Is he surprisingly large for a footballer, Wilson? I thought this about Jason Denier in the semi-final as well. I was very pleased to see someone really big playing at such elite level football.
Yeah, I'd like to know how big he actually is. I don't know if you found this with footballers, but they're always smaller in real life than you expect them to be.
Absolutely right. Darren Ambrose, who came into the radio studio after me and Barry's show this afternoon, I mean, like a wisp, wasn't he, Barry? I was expecting Ambrose to be at least a head taller than that.
Yeah, I was about to say the exact same thing, that I met Darren Ambrose today and he was small. See also, who's the... David Connolly. He's tiny and looks like a gust of wind would blow him over. And you wonder, how can you have scored so many goals?
Well, the player who or, you know, I was genuinely stunned by. I was interviewing Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, at Real Madrid's training complex. And I walked out of the room afterwards into the corridor. And there was this tiny bloke wearing just a towel, like incredibly muscular, but tiny. So he looked like some kind of... you know, you see those hideous child bodybuilders, and he looked like that, and I was like, oh God, that's a youth team player's gonna hold me wrong, and then realised it was Claude Makélélé, and he was the idea that he could control the midfield. I mean, he looked like a Sabitio player off his base.
Yeah, I felt the same when I met N'Golo Kante. I was like, I looked down at him like you look down at a small child and thought, there's no way he can be better than me at football. He's so tiny, but turns out he is. Patrick says, which of these Bayern Munich players would Tony Pulis have got the most out of?
Oh, he'd like Nicolas Sule, I reckon.
He'd like Sule.
You do a job at fullback for Tony.
Probably right. Not many people know that Serge Gnabry actually was at West Brom for a brief period. A couple more points. Paul says, I don't have BT Sport in the UK. It was free to air on YouTube. It's the first time I've had the chance to see the much-hyped Alphonso Davies. Poor man's John Beresford, he says. William says, how many pints of Gazprom can Jonathan Wilson drink in one sitting?
Sorry, John Beresford, he scored twice in a game away for Newcastle against Dynamo Kiev. God, 20 years ago, I can't remember exactly when. And... it was Ian St. John doing the co-commentary, and he described it as the most amazing thing ever. Yeah, better than the resurrection, better than the invention of electricity, better than anything else. John Beresford's going twice away against Dynamo Kiev.
It's like when commentators say that, oh, well, he's shown Robin onto his left foot there or whatever, and he's paid the ultimate price. And I think that's not the ultimate price. That's a failure of imagination on your part.
But Alphonso Davies didn't actually have a very good game tonight. I mean, I think he's a really good player, but he did look, certainly after he got the yellow card, I thought he looked a bit edgy.
Do you think this is he peaked in the semi-final.
Well, it might
and
be.
And now forevermore, he'll be just not quite. He'll be like 0.75 Beresfords every game now.
It might just be that Koeman doesn't protect him in the way that Perisic does. I think that's probably the most likely thing. Oh, I know, it's also, you know, he's a kid who's barely played any football, suddenly playing in the Champions League final. And I guess at some point it suddenly dawns on you that Christ, is the Champions League final.
A lot's been made of this, you know, whether this is a victory for football, Barry, PSG losing. What do you think?
The whole aim of the Qatari PSG project was for them to win the Champions League and have that on their national CV, I suppose, to divert people's attention away from the appalling abuses heaped on migrant workers in the country. And... you know, has it been a failure? Barney wrote a column today saying just about being in the final, they've achieved their aims. I have to say, the thing that sort of puzzles me about the whole sports washing thing is, given my you know, I like to think I'm reasonably well read and know a fair bit about a fair bit. I wouldn't be aware of half of what's going on in Qatar, the bad things, if it wasn't for the fact that they'd got the World Cup and owned PSG. So I don't know if that's a case of their attempts at sports washing backfiring or not, because their involvement in football and their desire to win the Champions League and to get the World Cup have really turned me on to what is going on in Qatar as stuff I probably wouldn't be aware of otherwise.
I mean, I think there's there's a natural tendency to celebrate this result, and I think, you know, understandably there are a lot of people out there who won't want PSG to win a thing. To me, it feels a little bit like when Usain Bolt beat Justin Gatlin at the 2015 World Championship. It was kind of held up as this great victory for the sport. Almost like this white knight coming to the rescue of a doomed and broken and tarnished sport. And I think, you know, those narratives are always slightly flawed. Like Barney wrote in his really, really brilliant piece for The Observer today, that the fact that, you know, what Qatar wanted out of PSG was success, visibility, shock and awe, upsetting the established order, and essentially blazoning their name across the bigger stages in the sport. And to that extent, you know, they've already succeeded. And you know, Bayern, who by the way also have significant Qatari investment, you know, it might feel transiently good for them to have beaten them tonight, but it feels also like quite a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, the game is kind of lying in ruins around us, and I don't think one result really changes that at all.
Yeah, I mean, because the point is that this isn't it for PSG. In 5 years, they're still going to be there at the top table. If there is a Super League, they'll be involved in it. If there is this expanded Club World Cup, they'll be part of it. They will win the Champions League at some point. It's been deferred for another year, but yeah, to an extent, so what? And I sort of have similar doubts to Barry as to what extent has this been successful for Qatar's aims? To what extent is it shone a spotlight on things they probably don't want the spotlight shone upon? And to be honest, I don't feel equipped to sort of even begin to kind of approach that question. I don't understand enough about what they're trying to do. I'm sure that their aim is not to convince people like me that they're a good place. Their sort of broader aim of enhancing the reputation image of a country, that's what they're trying to do. Whether they've done that with the right people or not, I don't feel equipped to answer.
Do you know, did anyone read Simon Cooper's article in the Financial Times about PSG? Because I thought that was quite interesting in the sort of the complexities and the nuances of that football club, because quite often they're sort of painted, especially with these owners now, but just as a bit of a plastic team anyway, that you know, only been about since 1970. But actually that's quite a long time ago now. And actually some of the suburbs around Paris that have a lot of PSG fans have also only been around since about 1970 as well, and that even though obviously there are these problems with his ownership that we've talked about here and on other podcasts, that there is still a sort of, it's difficult for those Paris Saint-Germain fans, and there are lots of really legitimate PSG fans who love that football team. And I just thought it was quite an interesting article that I hadn't considered that part of it.
I read that article. I mean, can I be frank about it? I thought,
yeah, please.
Articles like that are exactly why states like Qatar invest in teams like PSG. Do we really think that Qatar have, you know, the slightest emotional investment in Paris as a city and a community?
I don't think they do, but I don't think that means that the people in the city don't have that.
No, I mean, but it's the same as with Manchester City, that are a club with history and are a club with heritage and tradition and loyal fans who are from the city and care about the city and the community and the place and the traditions of the club, and have essentially been kind of taken over by, you know, they are a host body for this kind of this parasitic, you know, influence from Abu Dhabi in City's case and Qatar in PSG's case. And I think part of why they buy into things like this is that the sheer, you know, I guess the aesthetic beauty of what they create, you know, having Neymar and Di Maria and Mbappe in the same front three, or creating like this beautiful football under Guardiola. That's what they do. And I think pieces like, you know, Simon Cooper's a journalist I really respect, but I think that piece was the sort of unthinking money worship that is actually quite characteristic of the FT and most of its vacuous readers.
It's like when Amanda Staveley gave her boo-hoo, woe is us interview to certain favoured journalists after the Newcastle Saudi takeover fell through, and she was talking about how much she had fallen in love with Newcastle and how much great charitable work her and her chums were going to do in the area. And it's the stuff Newcastle fans wanted to hear. It went totally unchallenged, and it was a pile of shite, to be
honest.
Bollocks. You know,
it's bollocks, it's PR, and it's bollocks.
What, both?
But
the
people
pieces.
But people will fall for it. So
yeah, you know, I mean, I fell for
it's
it.
Probably worth it.
Well, I fell for.
Well, you're an exceptionally gullible man.
Well, maybe, but I just was proud I'd read something in the Financial Times. I thought I must be an intellectual.
No, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I mean, to people who didn't read the piece, it was like, you know, PSG. They were kind of a basket case of a club. They had real hooligan elements, and this persisted well into the 90s. And now they don't. And you know, that's probably, you know, on its own, that's a good thing. But what has it taken for that to come about? And I thought there was a staggering lack of perspective in that piece.
All right, good. I'll read it again and then change what I tweeted about it. Overall Champions League statistics then. Bayern top scorers with 43, PSG second with 25. Lewandowski, the top scorer, getting 15. Erling Braut Haaland got 10. Bayern Munich won all their games. Quiz for you, Barry, on the big moments of this year's Champions League.
Oh, no.
It's a yes or no answer. Do you remember Cluj 4, Celtic 3?
No.
Spurs 2, Bayern Munich 7?
Yes.
Dortmund 3, Inter Milan 2?
No.
Atalanta 1, Man City 1?
Yes.
Kyle Walker went in goal.
Is that a question or a statement?
It's just a statement. Do you remember it? Do you remember it?
Yes. Yes.
He's only goalkeeper not to be beaten by Atalanta this season in the Champions League.
Yeah, excellent stat. Liverpool 2, Atletico 3.
Yes.
Bayern Munich 8, Barcelona 2. You must remember that one.
Oh, I remember that one.
Excellent,
right, yeah.
News. Well done, Barry. You win a prize. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll discuss the Europa League final. Part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So on Friday night, Sevilla beat Inter Milan 3-2. An own goal from Romelu Lukaku late on, clinching it for Sevilla, winning their record sixth Europa League trophy. Inter now 10 years without a trophy. And this was a brilliant game of football, Barry, wasn't it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Every second of it, I was doing the minute by minute for the Guardian. Four goals in the first half. Normally you'd be effing and jeffing, like, lads, come on, give me a chance to try and keep up here. But I suppose the talking point, and the only talking point on BT Sport after the game, and it was a bit of a shame because it was a wonderful game, was the fact that Lukaku's diverted a Diego Carlos overhead kick into his own net. Diego Carlos should not have been on the pitch. I know Jonathan Wilson has plenty to say about this, so over to you, Jonathan Wilson.
Yeah, he shouldn't. I mean, this double jeopardy law that you now don't get sent off if you concede a penalty while stopping a goal-scoring opportunity, if it's an honest attempt or, you know, a genuine attempt to play the ball, is now just being used by referees to bottle out decisions. There's no way that pulling somebody's shoulder, then standing on their heel, is a genuine attempt to play the ball. Lukaku was one stride from having a shot, or potentially having a shot. Nothing in the law says it has to be a good goal-scoring opportunity. Nothing says it has to be, you know, an XG above 0.3 or whatever. Lukaku could have had a shot in his next stride. He gets pulled down. It's a red card. And it goes back to something we've said before, Barry, that any cynical foul should be a red card. And then you don't have to even consider whether there's defenders getting back or any of that nonsense.
You'd think what they need to do is, if they brought in video technology, they could look at these major incidents and then change the decisions.
Well, no, but if the referee hasn't not seen that, he clearly has seen it because he's given a penalty. It's just cowardice. It's the same as the FA Cup final when Azpilicueta's not sent off. It's referees in a final bottling it, presumably under some kind of bizarre sense that they don't want to ruin the spectacle. But what ruins the spectacle is cynical fouls. And if you let them go, I mean...
It's not easy to discern what a cynical foul is. I mean, even on a replay, this is the problem with trying to discern intent.
Okay, it is easy if he's pulling his shirt, because pulling a shirt can only be cynical. There's no way you can win the ball by pulling somebody's shirt.
Right, so, I mean, by your rationale, if somebody's pulling a player's shirt while they're taking a shot from 35 yards, which is a goal-scoring opportunity, they should be sent off.
Yes.
It's a view, to be sure.
Even if they're not having a shot, even if they're running nowhere near the ball, if you pull somebody's shirt, red card straight away.
Yeah, but what if two players are pulling each other's shirts? That happens.
Send them both off.
Wow.
Make shirts out of anti-vandal paint. That would soon stop it.
Or just have everyone play nude and cover them in Vaseline, like Adama Traore or baby oil. Sorry, not Vaseline. But the ref here in this game was the Dutchman, Danny McAley. So he was very much in the McAley role as he declined to send off Diego Carlos. But look, let's not dwell on that. Apart from that, it was, you know, anyway, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play? It was a wonderful game. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think it was one of the first games I've watched since football started again where I was oblivious to the fact that there wasn't a crowd there. I just kind of got lost in the actual game, and the fact the stands were empty was lost on me.
And you know, that second header from Luke de Jong is absolutely glorious, isn't it? And you know, for people who only watch the Premier League and then go, well, hang on, he was at Newcastle for about 10 minutes and was absolutely bobbing.
Was he at West Brom under Tony Pulis?
Almost certainly. But like, good for him. Good for Luke de Jong. I was very pleased for him. And he looked very happy about it all. It's quite remarkable, Sevilla.
He's the kind of player Newcastle would have signed if that Saudi takeover had gone through.
Sevilla's run is quite amazing. Can you name all the teams that they've beaten in the Europa League final, Wilson?
Yeah, I think I've certainly been to them all, apart from Inter. So, Espanyol.
Correct.
They beat at Hampden Park. Middlesbrough they beat in Eindhoven.
Correct.
Which was the day before the first test shown on Sky, because I had to get a 5 a.m. flight to get back in time to go to Lourdes to cover that game.
Right.
They beat Dnipro in Warsaw the day of the FIFA arrests.
Okay. You don't need to give me extra information if you don't want to.
They beat Benfica.
Yes.
On penalties.
You got one more
to go. We have to go to part four here.
And who's the other one?
2016.
Oh, yeah, Liverpool, of course, in Bern.
Correct. Of course, correct. Well done. Did we like one-leg games? Do you think there's any case for them being brought into the Champions League or the Europa League? Alexander Zeferin, UEFA president, saying, "We were forced to do it, but in the end we see that we found out something new, so we will think about it in the future for sure." John?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could work for the Europa League, which, you know, let's face it, people only really tangentially care about. There's absolutely no way it'll come in permanently in the Champions League. Those extra, what is it, six, you know, games of TV revenue, they're not gonna chuck that away. But I think it's you know, it definitely changed the dynamic. There's no way, for example, I think that Leipzig beat Atletico over two legs, or Lyon beat Man City over two legs. I don't think that happened. So in that respect, I think it was kind of an interesting spectacle, and for something like the Europa League, it could be like a unique selling point. This idea of having, you know, all the games in 2 weeks, it was really exciting. It was great having like a, you know, European football every night for 2 weeks. It's a different discipline, I think, to playing two-legged football over the space of a month or 2 months, which is what the latter stages are currently like. It was an interesting experiment.
With what Chefferman said, my suspicion is that he can't have noticed that the two-legged format's produced some incredible drama, incredible games in the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah. So therefore, you think, why is he saying this? And I guess if you make, I don't know, whether it's the quarterfinals onwards or the semifinals onwards, a sort of mini tournament, UEFA then has more power. They have more control over that than you know, when it's at the home venues of clubs. So I presume it's a political move. But I wonder as well whether, I mean, there's something great about tournament football in that, so it's as if history speeded up, that suddenly all these narratives come together and everything's resolved within, you know, in the space of 2 or 3 days, the story's moved on. And, you know, we've almost forgotten the PEPSA fraud now, because that happened, you know, a week ago, which is what happens at World Cups, that the careers rise and fall in the space of 2 or 3 days. Would we have looked so fondly on that had we had the European Championship as well this summer, or would that be too much? But what I think it does bode well for is the Club World Cup in its expanded form, if they can ever find a space in the calendar for that. This does work in club football, this sense of narratives coming together and there's momentum you get in the tournament. It was good fun. But I think Johnny's right. I think it won't happen just because partly because the clubs want the money and partly because the big clubs realise that there is more chance for shock the fewer legs you have.
Now, the Women's Champions League semi-final lineup was fixed over the weekend. Well, it wasn't fixed. just to be clear about that. They all played matches. Lyon will play PSG on Wednesday. Wolfsburg will play Barcelona on Tuesday night. And they'll be covered on the pods in midweek. Harry Maguire has pleaded not guilty, being released from police custody following his arrest on the island of Mykonos. A court date has been set for Tuesday. Maguire can be represented by his lawyer and will now return home. The prosecutor's office said that 3 foreigners had been arrested after an alleged altercation with police officers on Thursday. The police say a file has been opened, which includes accusations of violence against officials, disobedience, bodily harm, insult, and attempted bribery of an official. A Manchester United statement said Harry has pleaded not guilty to the charges. It would be inappropriate for the player or the club to comment further while the legal process takes its course. And that's what we'll do as well. We'll discuss it as and when there's a verdict. Finally, Jonathan Wilson, have you seen this? There is a new TV series coming out called Ted Lasso, about an American coming to be a soccer coach. And in one scene, he is seen reading Inverting the Pyramid.
Well, I think it's the bloke behind him on the plane is seen reading it.
Okay.
I mean, what I've seen from still photographs on Twitter.
Yeah. So that's how do you feel about this?
Well, the program itself, if the best of the programs is on the trailers, then it's one of the worst things ever made. So slightly embarrassed to be associated with it, to be honest.
Wilson is worried about is whether the guy sitting behind Ted Lasso actually paid for his copy of Inverting the Pyramid or got it in a second-hand shop or out of a bargain bin like most wrong-thinking people.
It looks terrible. I think it came from it was an NBC or some CBS comedy sketch or that they've managed to drag out to a whole series I don't like it at all.
Ted Lasso's assistant manager, producer Sammy, is reading the Inverting the Pyramid. Well, you know, you'd have thought at least at some point someone in the production team said we need a runner to at least order Inverting the Pyramid online. So good for you, Jonathan.
I like the idea that this terrible comedy character, even he considered Inverting the Pyramid beneath him and designated the reading of it to his assistant.
Producer Sammy also points out, let's hope that TV show is not thinking of sponsoring the pod after what was a glowing review of a program none of us have watched. I for one, think it looks absolutely excellent. And I very much hope that there's a big article in the Financial Times about it and I will read it and I will drink it in. That's what I'll do. And that'll do for today. Thank you for your time, Barry.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks.
Cheers, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
I'm off for a few pods. Melissa Rudd will be sitting in for me on the next one. So be nice to her. But obviously not too nice, but be nice. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.